The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in Curcumin Resveratrol Omega. Temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains. Temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains. And you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. It's the story of your life. You're moving down. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt on this Wednesday. Good morning to you. You already know the biggest news of yesterday. Derek Chauvin was convicted by the jury in about 10 hours of deliberation to find him guilty on all three charges: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, second-degree manslaughter. I had called it murder from the first day I saw the tape, and so it took a long time to get there, but I can't say I'm surprised. I can't say anyone is surprised, and I know there's a lot of coverage about it, but more of relief for the family of George Floyd than anything else. Still, some politicians said remarkably dumb things. Nancy Pelosi taking the lead. Here's what she said, cut number 17.
Thank you, George Floyd, for sacrificing your life for justice, for being there to call out to your mom. How heartbreaking was that?
All right, that's it. George Floyd was murdered. George Floyd was murdered. And Nancy Pelosi attempting to turn a murder into a political statement is, to me, just nuts. He was murdered. He did not make a statement. He did not sacrifice himself. He was murdered. Nancy Pelosi sometimes operates on a plane that I do not understand. I do understand Maxine Waters almost being censored yesterday. Not one Democrat voted to censor her before the verdict came back for encouraging violence in the aftermath of an innocent verdict, which wasn't going to come, but it was still unnecessary for Maxine to come. And she was playing with matches there. There might have been a technical reason the jury might have not convicted. I didn't see it, but I didn't follow the trial that closely, just headlines. Leader McConnell, Republican leader in the Senate, scolded Maxine Waters. Cut number six.
Well, look, one of the hallmarks of our system is people are entitled to a fair trial. Sometimes a fair trial is difficult to conduct under these kinds of circumstances, but it is certainly not helpful for a member of Congress and even the President of the United States to appear to be weighing in public while the jury is trying to sort through this significant case. They're entitled to a fair trial, and hopefully that's what will happen.
I'm pretty sure the judge went to great lengths during voir dire to make sure people hadn't been polluted or had preconceived opinion. Now, I declare on this radio show, just like other people declared their opinion, that murder was involved from day one. But if any of the jurors had been polluted during that, they wouldn't have gotten onto the jury box. And I just can't imagine the President of the United States and Maxine Waters urging guilty verdicts and threatening violence in the case of Maxine Waters. You meet Alcindor, a friend of mine. She is more to the left than I am to the right. People should understand that. I've done a number of shows with Yamiche over the years. She's a wonderful person, but she is far more to the left than I am to the right. She showed it at a White House press conference talking about Maxine. Cut number nine.
Representative Waters, as you said, clarified. She said, my actual words don't matter. I wonder why the White House isn't also coming to the defense of Representative Waters, given the fact that she's now facing an onslaught of attacks, especially by, I would say, Republicans. I wonder why the White House isn't saying, we back what she said about being confrontational. She was obviously not threatening violence. There are civil rights leaders that are saying
Stop here for a second. Yamiche's conclusory there, as I would say, objection, Your Honor, conclusory. Why isn't the White House helping out my liberal friend Maxine? I'm kind of amazed at Yamiche. She's a good journalist. She knows that's an unbalanced and completely biased question. But she got it in. Don Lemon made Yamiche look like Walter Cronkite, though. Don Lemon on CNN with Wolf, come number 12.
Look at me, everyone. Do you really think Maxine Waters is calling for violence? Maxine Waters is
done.
Not calling for
look
violence.
At me. Yes, she was. And you're never going to win the spelling bee, and everybody knows it, and you'll be canceled as soon as there's a new CNN ownership. And you know it, and I know it. It's because nobody watches your show because you say dumb things like that. And I hope you land on your feet. Honestly, that's just so dumb. Look at me. Look at me. There's nobody in the room to look at you. The only reason you had an audience is you're on Wolf's show, which is, Wolf will continue. Wolf, I actually don't think Wolf is a human life form. I think Wolf comes from somewhere else. He doesn't age. He doesn't pause. He doesn't miss a day of work. Wolf is Wolf, but to get an audience, Don had to go on Wolf's show. Now let's get to the other stories of the day, and there are a lot of them. Most prominent among them, we're about to have a war in Central Europe. Russia has got 150,000 troops ready to go into Ukraine on the border. They have also forward-based the kind of fighter and bombing aircraft consistent with an invasion of Ukraine. Putin issued a statement yesterday, we know how to defend our interests, and he is massing troops near Ukraine, according to the New York Times, in an effort to telegraph what's coming. He's imbuing his position with alleged moral authority and a thinning supply of patience. They may think that we are like them, but we are different with a different genetic, cultural, and moral code. We know how to defend our interests. He's openly contemptuous of President Biden. And when this comes, the question is, what will the United States do? Now, the first thing that ought to happen is not a United States move. Germany ought to cancel immediately Nord Stream 2 and should announce it now if they want to stop the invasion of Ukraine. Just if you invade Ukraine, Russia, Nord Stream 2 is over. We're ripping it out of the ground. You're not going to sell gas in Europe. And Angela Merkel, who's an appeaser, will probably not do that, but she should do that. And the United States should announce, if you invade Ukraine, we're going to disintermediate every asset we can find of every oligarch and Putin everywhere in the world because they are a gangster state. If you invade Ukraine a second time, now you did it under Obama and you've waited 4 years to do it again under Biden because you know they're both weak. But the Congress isn't weak and they can pass by overwhelming majorities disintermediation instructions. I asked Tom Cotton about it yesterday. We can do it. And we ought to get it done. Now, let me turn to two stories. There's a story in the Post this morning. I'm still a zero. Vaccine-resistant Republicans warn that their skepticism is worsening. 40% of Republicans have consistently told pollsters they're not planning to get vaccinated. Frank Luntz has done a focus group on Sunday over the Zoom. And the Zoom tells us that, I like to say that because some old people I now call it the Zoom, like the Borg. That they're not going to get, they don't care, they heard all sorts of focus group doctors, they're not going to do it for a variety of reasons, unknown long-term effects, baseless claims suggesting the shots would change the recipient's DNA. I've never even been able to track that one down. Okay, to my Republican friends and to everyone who hasn't gotten a vaccine who's not a Republican, let me give you one study that came out of Great Britain today. In a study of tens of thousands of people, tens of thousands of people. Of those who got the vaccine, only 32 were hospitalized. During the period of the study, same period of time, 74,000 people were admitted to the hospital with the virus who hadn't had the vaccine. So those are two different studies, but I want you to understand what that means. If you get the vaccine, you're not going to end up in a hospital. The odds are overwhelmingly against it. By the way, they're almost insignificant about Johnson & Johnson. And the Johnson & Johnson fiasco by the FDA and CDC is contributing to people's reluctance to get vaccinated. But only 72 people, 32 people, 32 people ended up in the hospital with COVID who had been vaccinated in all of Great Britain. 32 people. It's so rare. If you get the vaccine, you're not going to the hospital. That's an almost take it to the bank. Contrast that with 74,000 people who went to the hospital who didn't get the vaccine. Now, some of you had COVID like Dwayne and haven't had the vaccine. We have no guidance on that yet. When Dr. Fauci comes back, I'll ask him, or when someone comes forward with that, I would like to say that. But the overwhelming evidence is get the vaccine. Get the vaccine, get the vaccine. Any kind that is available to you. Now, I've got some friends who didn't get the vaccine, and if you are listening to me, please, I'm begging you, get the vaccine. I would prefer to have you around. Now, odds of dying are low. They're less than 2%, unless you are older and have a comorbidity, in which case they get higher. And I don't want my friends to die or anybody else to die. Go get the vaccine. It's like preventing death from COVID. I mean, you can still get hit by a car on your way to the vaccine center. I'm not saying that. You could be near the Dwayne Patterson off-ramp up there on the toll road in Orange County. You don't want to go down that. That could kill most people. Didn't kill Dwayne. But the vaccine will save your life. Meanwhile, when we come back, the Super League fell apart. Yesterday's big story. This is a triumph of the fan. So I'm going to cover it when we come back. Procter & Gamble is going to raise their prices in September. Inflation is coming. Simon & Schuster stood up to the woke people on their staff. They're going to publish Mike Pence's book, Good for Jonathan Karp, the head of Simon & Schuster, and much, much more. My number is 1-800-520-1234. 1-800-520-1234. What should we do when Ukraine invades? 1-800-520-1234. Connection to the Hugh Hewitt.
True patriot love in all our sons' command.
Canada here at the Hugh Hewitt Show, and they are getting smashed by COVID right now. The largest city, Toronto, and neighboring Peel are both in the midst of third wave COVID-19 infections. On Tuesdays, they said they would order businesses to close if the outbreaks involving five or more people occur there for a minimum of 10 days. Across the country in Ontario, they've got crackdowns as well. It's really a smash up there. Way to go, Justin Trudeau. Been 15 months and they can't figure it out up in Canada. India, which has great infrastructure problems, had 2,000 dead yesterday from COVID. 2,000 deaths in a single day in India. The number increased by 295,000 over 24 hours. These are real numbers. India actually keeps track. We're not sure. Now they keep track. They did in the beginning. The United States never let in death. The United States never let in infections. It had to be one of the populous countries. Nobody was noticing it. China won't tell us. India will tell us. And that's the scale that they've got going on. And then we've got Japan on the edge of cracking down everywhere. They're supposed to have the Olympics in 2 months. Not sure that's going to happen. They've got considering crackdowns in Tokyo, et cetera. So it's a very, very grim situation on the virus front, except in the United States and Israel and the United Kingdom. But I go back to the message I gave you at the beginning of the show. The United Kingdom story in the Telegraph this morning is all you need to know about whether or not you're one of those. There is a focus group Frank Luntz has been running that shows a number of Republicans don't want to get it. And they've got some weird theory that it changes your DNA, which is simply not true. That's from the weird spot on the internet where all the lies go to metastasize. It does not change your DNA. It's perfectly safe. It's safer even than the Johnson & Johnson, which you can't get right now, which you should be able to get now. And although more than half of the United States adults have received at least one dose, more than 40% of Republicans, self-identifying Republicans, have consistently told pollsters they're not planning to be vaccinated. That's just nuts. That's crazy. And the reason that's crazy is because of the study out of Great Britain of people who received the vaccine. And that's hundreds of thousands, millions of people in Great Britain now. Only 32 people have been hospitalized. You do not get sick. I don't know who these 32 people are, but that's close to nil. You have very infinitesimal risk of getting COVID sickness if you do not. If you get vaccinated, you're going to be fine. If you don't get vaccinated, well, 74,000 people went to the hospital in the same period of time as the study of the 32 who were hospitalized among the vaccinated. So this is like Jupiter versus a crumb from your coffee cake. It is. It's like the universe versus your tiny bit of pizza crumb left on the plate last night. You've got to get vaccinated, people. You've just got to get vaccinated. It's not close, and it's crazy if you don't. They had a hearing yesterday about the smear Georgia campaign. You know, Major League Baseball became a Democrat sport, a blue sport. Coke became a Democratic Coca. Don't drink Coke. If you're a Republican, they hate you, so don't buy their products. If you're a Republican, don't fly Delta. They hate you, too, and Major League Baseball hates you, and I'm sorry to hear that. The Indians lost last night again to the White Sox. I'll watch it. I won't buy tickets. Won't fly Delta if I have any choice. Not going to drink any Coke products. But they had Stacey Abrams, who led the smear Georgia campaign in the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday, and Tom Cotton had this exchange, cut number one.
Ms. Abrams, I want to talk about your role in the decision by Major League Baseball to boycott the state of Georgia and move the All-Star Game at an estimated cost of $100 million in economic activity and thousands of jobs for Georgia's residents. On March 8th, when describing the Georgia election law, you called it Jim Crow in a suit and tie. On March 10th, well before the Georgia election law was passed, you registered the website StopJimCrow2.com. On March 14th, you called the Georgia election bill a redux of Jim Crow. On March 25th, the bill passed into law. On March 31st, you wrote an op-ed in the USA Today about Georgia's law, and your first two words in that op-ed were, "Boycotts work." 2 days later, on April 2nd, Major League Baseball announced its boycott of Georgia. According to media reports in the days leading up to Major League Baseball's decision to pull the All-Star Game from Georgia, you spoke with baseball executives, you described the law as Jim Crow 2.0, and you urged Major League Baseball to speak out. But after its decision to withdraw the game from Georgia, you conveniently claimed that you had strongly urged them not to boycott after the horse was out of the barn and the damage was already done. So, Ms. Abrams, in sum, you publicly attacked the Georgia law as Jim Crow no fewer than 10 times before Major League Baseball withdrew the game. You told corporations that boycotts work, and you told corporations that if they don't attack Georgia's law, quote, "I cannot argue with an individual's choice to opt out for their competition."
Thank you, Stacey Abrams, for destroying Georgia and forcing Major League Baseball into being a blue state. Ted Cruz added on to this, cut number two.
Ms. Abrams, it's been over 2 years, and you still refuse to concede that you lost the race for governor in Georgia in 2018. You have said that, quote, "you do not concede that the process was proper," and that, quote, "they stole it from the voters of Georgia." Yes or no, today, do you still maintain that the 2018 Georgia election was stolen?
As I have always said, I acknowledged at the very beginning that that Brian Kemp won under the rules that were in place. What I object to are rules that permitted thousands of Georgia voters to be denied their participation in this election or to have their votes cast out. And so I will continue to disagree with the system until it is fixed. We have seen market progress made, and unfortunately, it was undone in SB 202. But I will continue to advocate for a system that permits every eligible Georgian to cast their ballot.
Ms. Abrams, I'm going to ask you to please answer the question I asked, which is, do you, yes or no, do you still maintain the 2018 election was stolen? That's your language.
My full language was that it was stolen from the voters of Georgia. We do not know what they would have done because not every eligible Georgian was permitted to participate fully in the election.
So you also told the New York Times that your loss, quote, was fully attributable to voter suppression. Ms. Abrams, do you know in Georgia whether the percentage of African-American Georgians who are registered to vote and who turned out to vote, is it higher or lower than the national average?
It is higher than the national average because Georgia is one of the largest states with an African-American population.
But that's not tied to the size of the population. The percentage of black Georgians who are registered to vote in 2018 is 64.7%. That compares to 60.2% as the national average. The percentage of Georgians who voted in 2018, the election you claim was stolen from you, was 56.3%. That's higher than the national average of 48%. Let me ask you this, Ms. Abrams. In 2018, do you know which demographic group in Georgia had the highest registration percentage and the highest turnout percentage?
I have a guess, but I will defer to you for the answer.
The answer is African Americans had the highest registration and the highest turnout, despite your claiming that the election was stolen and there was somehow voter suppression. Let's shift to the Georgia law in particular, which there have been mountains of lies spread by both Democratic politicians and by the press. Does the Georgia law reduce the number of early voting days? Yes or no?
Yes. It does so because you have to look at it in total. It is not simply looking at the number of days that were expanded for 40% of the population, which for 60% of the population had been the norm. It also has to look at the early voting runoff days that were indeed shortened.
Is it correct that the law increases the number of mandatory days of early weekend voting?
It is a partial answer to say that certain days were increased in certain counties that had not participated in the use of all of those days of elections. They had been optional, and most 60% of Georgians had been able to vote for those full number of days. 40% will now join, and that is a good thing. But at the exact same time, the same bill eliminates weeks of early voting during runoff elections and limits and allows the elimination of weekend voting.
Do you believe that requiring an ID to vote suppresses votes?
As I have said, written, testified, and repeated today, I believe that voter identification is always appropriate. You should know who is voting. What I object to are the ways that we are narrowing and restricting who has access to the right to vote, and that has been a common and necessary complaint. As we noted in 2018, what happened to Native Americans in North Dakota who were denied the right to vote because they were required to have photo identification that included language and included perquisites that they were not entitled to demand. When we have narrowing of opportunities without expansion of access, that is absolutely wrong, and I will stand against it in Georgia and everywhere.
During the 2020 election, did your organization, Fair Fight, collect ballots for voters? And if so, were the people collecting ballots for your organization paid?
We did not collect ballots. We did not pay people to collect ballots. We sent to voters absentee ballot applications, as did the Secretary of State, as did a number of other organizations, because in the midst of a pandemic, we thought it was important for voters who may or may not have had information about what their rights were to ensure that they had the education and opportunity for engagement in our elections.
So I want to be clear about your testimony to this committee. Your testimony is that your organization did not pay any person in the state of Georgia in 2020 to collect ballots for anybody else.
No, sir.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll see about that. Raphael Warnock, who was elected senator and is up for re-election, said this about all these details, cut number 25.
We may be tempted to dissect these bills as if analyzing them piece by piece makes them more rational. But that narrow analysis only obscures the larger, unmistakable picture.
That means don't look at the bill, don't read the bill, listen to my lies about the bill. Raphael Warnock and Stacey Abrams, responsible for Georgia suffering devastating economic blows as a result of misinformation about a bill that they did not like. Good morning, Eliana. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm great. How are you?
Good. Did you know about this injunction in L.A.?
This is the first I've heard of it. I think I may have seen one reference on Twitter, but have not been following it closely.
No, it's a great story. I hope you send someone over to cover it, because we haven't seen injunctive relief like this since busing was ordered back in the days of systemic racial bias in segregated school cases. You're from Minneapolis. I am not surprised by what happened yesterday. Are you surprised by what happened yesterday?
Not at all.
And so why does the media then upset? I mean, it was a murder. I saw it. I called it. I think everyone who saw it knew that there were going to be at least manslaughter and probably a conviction. But we had 24/7 on it yesterday as though it was in doubt. Was it too much coverage?
I don't think it was too much coverage. In a lot of ways, it was like the first trial of the century of the 21st century in terms of all the attention paid. And I think your reference to the media coverage, you know, media thrives from tension and opposition. So, of course, like they need to create some suspense around this. You know, not the best far from the best legal commentary I've seen from many in the press before the verdict. But that doesn't surprise me either.
All right. So I'm not spending a lot of time on it because I don't want to credit people with thinking it was a close run deal. It was not a close run deal. Andy McCarthy did the best he could to come up with the possible explanation why a manslaughter verdict would come in as opposed to a second or third degree murder. But I very rarely comment on these things unless you're in the courtroom. You don't know. I just couldn't believe it. Let me turn to Ukraine. There are 150,000 Russian troops on the border. They have now forward staged combat, aircraft and bombers. It looks like an invasion. What do you think Team Biden will do if it is an invasion?
Cannot speak to what they will do. I will say I've been following closely sort of the signals that each side has been sending. Russia's signals, of course, of increasing aggression. The Biden administration canceled the deployment of two warships to the region and slapped some relatively toothless sanctions on Russia. What I'm most interested in is we saw a report in Axios a couple of days ago that Putin had ordered the new U.S. ambassador, John Sullivan, there to leave the country, and he was sticking to his guns and was going to force Putin to escalate the situation before leaving. And not two or three hours later, the report was that Ambassador Sullivan is heading home to consult with his colleagues in the Biden administration. So I don't know what the details there are, but I do think all the signals have been to Russia, including around Navalny's detention and illness, that the Biden administration will not respond in a way that would deter Russian aggression.
That's appeasement. And they haven't even persuaded Germany to issue a statement. The most obvious sanction is the deconstruction of Nord Stream 2 and maybe Nord Stream 1, which is working, and cutting off Russian gas sales to Western Europe and doing so immediately, as well as forward deployment to Poland, the Baltic states, and any other NATO member bordering Russia or close to Russia of additional NATO troops out of Germany. I haven't seen anything like that, Eliana. And I think Putin is going to just roll over Biden and realize that the window is open for business.
I think that's a likely outcome, and none of the sanctions that the administration put down had any sort of impact on Nord Stream 2. I think you're right about the salience of that particular project as well.
What about taking Putin's money? I asked Tom Cotton about it yesterday. He said, and we posted the interview at Hewitt.com, that we have the ability to go and get some of Putin's money and the oligarchs' money generally. Do you think we'll do any of that?
I don't know. I think you might not be surprised to hear, Hugh, I'm not the most plugged in person with the Biden administration. But certainly, I think in this case, the public information can tell you, putting the pieces of public information together can tell you a lot about what's going on.
I agree. And now, John Kerry was in China last week, which is never a time to sleep easy. And he got a big commitment from President Xi to show up for the Zoom conference, which is, you know, everybody has sat through 5,000 Zoom meetings now, and they know that means nothing. It means that you're in your, you know, skivvies in your bedroom. And I know that she's going to show up. But I also worry and wonder if you do that when Ukraine gets hit by Putin, whether or not President Xi, General Secretary Xi, is going to eye Taiwan at that moment. He told us yesterday he's not going to. What do you think, Eliana Johnson?
All the signs we've seen from China do not signal that Xi doesn't have his eye on Taiwan, and particularly I point to China's aggression in Hong Kong. That's incredibly troubling. My concern is that the Biden administration, as with Iran, eyeing some sort of greater climate deal, overlooks China's regional aggression.
It's astonishing. It's the most complete reversal of American foreign policy. President Obama did not tell us he was going to be an appeaser, and then he appeased. Joe Biden pretty much telegraphed he is an appeaser, and appeasement is not going to work. And with Iran, I believe the headline is they're on the 60, I mean, they're close to 60% of the way to reviving the JCPOA, according to Sharif. Is that what your reporting is?
Yes, that's consistent with our reporting. And I think, look, they're going to get back in the deal. The outcome, in my view, is predetermined. And it seems to me they're trying to avoid total and abject humiliation on the road to a predetermined end.
It's just appeasement. It's just appeasement, appeasement, appeasement. Now, Eliana, in Israel, it appears that, are you following Netanyahu, appears to have met his political demise? If he gets out of this one, he really is Houdini.
Yeah, Netanyahu is certainly the person that you'd say reports of his demise are always premature. So I'll believe it when I see it. But he certainly is cat with nine lives.
I know that he was going to rely on Rahm. And last night I read every Israeli newspaper I could that said, look, Rahm is saying that they might still play with Netanyahu. But it just seems to me that the ultra-Orthodox Zionists, and there is an ultra-Orthodox Zionist camp, have said not now, not ever, never, in a way that can't be reversed. And what do you make? Do you know any of the personalities other than Netanyahu in Israel?
I don't. Jewish Insider is my read on all of these things, but no, I'm not personally close to it.
I don't know that. What is Jewish Insider?
Oh, wonderful publication that covers the important issues popping in the Jewish world every day. You got to sign up for the newsletter.
I read the Times of Israel. Is it better than the Times of Israel, which is a lot better than Jerusalem Post? Sorry to my Jerusalem Post friends, but the Times of Israel is better.
It's a different item, I would say, with a focus on the American Jewish community, but also Israel.
Do they get into the you know, I love Israeli politics. It's like it makes our politics look calm.
Absolutely calm and organized and, you know, well-oiled machine. Yes. The signature item is a morning newsletter that I recommend.
I will go get that. Axios this morning reporting that Christie is running for president. Are you surprised by that?
I am not surprised by that. Christie, I think, and Ron DeSantis, governor of Florida, are people. I don't have a whole lot of confidence that Christie will be the nominee, but I think they are people who have the sort of everyman personality that and aggressiveness and sort of stature that I can see how they think that they could be the Trump successor.
Yeah, the defining quality has got to be combativeness. And Christie, DeSantis, Cotton, Pompeo, and maybe Tim Scott in the top tier. Eliana Y. Johnson on Twitter, editor of Washington Free Beacon. Stay tuned, America. America, Chu Hewitt, playing a little Putin music this morning as he prepares to invade Ukraine. I'm joined by Congressman Mike Gallagher, and I'm ready to talk about that, Congressman. But a bit of levity at the first. I know you love Jeopardy. I want our audience to make sure that they see this episode of Jeopardy with your hero, Aaron Rodgers, as the guest host. Can we roll that, please?
Over to our two-day champion on the end. Scott, did you come up with the correct response? Who wanted to kick that field goal? That is a great question. Should be correct, but unfortunately for this game today, that's incorrect.
Did you notice how he froze, Mike? He just froze there. It was sort of like watching that game again.
I did watch that. I tweeted about that, and I called the contestant, I forget his name, a hero for bringing that up, because he is, of course, right, and Coach LaFleur is wrong, and I will go to my grave wondering what would have happened in that scenario if we made a different decision.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the obit that comes up that has, please send your donations to the field goal kicker whose life has been ruined by Matt LaFleur. All right, let's get to the serious thing. I've got a national interest story here. 150,000 troops. I thought it was 60,000 to 80,000. Russia now has on the Ukrainian border, and they have mobilized a bomber and fighter fleet there. All signs point to another invasion of Ukraine beyond what Russia has already done. What do you think of the situation?
Well, a couple of days ago in a hearing, I asked the commander of European Command what he rated as the likelihood of Russian invasion. And he said medium to low. But I have to tell you, I disagree with that assessment based on the open source imagery and reporting that I'm seeing, some of which you reference. This is the largest buildup since 2014, I believe. And if the Russians decide to invade, their current posture would only give us hours notice at a max. So questions we need to be asking the administration: how frequently are we communicating with the Ukrainians? How proactive are they being in terms of trying to deter China's deter Russia's forthcoming invasion? Does Putin feel this is a Georgia scenario where we have no appetite to intervene? And that is my biggest concern. If you start to add all these things up, whether it's the way the CCP lectured us in Alaska about racial politics in America, added to the unconditional surrender in Afghanistan, added to the continued Chinese buildup and harassment of Taiwan, all of these things start to equate to a climate of weakness, which our adversaries interpret as a climate of opportunity, a period of opportunity for them to make some incredible gains. And so we have to reestablish some credible deterrence ASAP. And perhaps the biggest thing we can do in Ukraine specifically is to get the javelins in play. As part of the sale of javelins, Ukraine had to store them in their western regions. We should move them to the front. The Biden administration should be rushing to push through additional sales ASAP, because this could quickly get out of hand.
Now, I am assuming an invasion is going to happen, in which case I'm assuming that Russia will win, given the overwhelming preponderance of force, even with the javelins that were intended to deter, not to defeat. When that happens, Germany, I believe, should suspend and deconstruct Nord Stream 1 and 2, and that we ought to forward deploy troops to every NATO country with a border in Russia. And there are, I believe, five of them. I could be wrong. What do you make of those two immediate responses?
I agree completely. And I fear, our European allies just don't want another problem, right? Particularly Germany, he referenced, and France. And so I doubt we're going to get any help from our NATO allies on this. I would actually sanction the people close to Putin, which the recent round of sanctions did not do. It was pretty weak if you start to dig into it. You can move a military group of advisors out to the east of Ukraine. You can send a group of ships, not just one, into the Black Sea and keep them there where their Spy One radars can monitor the border. You can kill, a variety of targets if need be. Also, I think critically, Russia shouldn't get a summit until they pull their troops back. In other words, they shouldn't be able to use their troops as a chit at a summit that they get some concession in return. So there's a lot of things we can do. But if this spirals, this is not amateur hour right now. And because we have to deal with this situation at the same time we're deterring the Chi-Coms from invading Taiwan, which, of course, Admiral Davidson said is likely within the next 6 years. I think it's likely within the next 3 years if we continue on our current course.
Well, it seems to me that we have nothing we can do in Ukraine if Putin decides to go forward other than second level sanctions, meaning forward deployments, disintermediation of assets. But we can deter Taiwan by sending the 7th Fleet to the Straits. That can happen. They could do that. They can send an unmistakable message of opposition to an invasion of Taiwan today. So that is not a lost cause. Ukraine would be a lost cause. And the question is, why does Putin fear Biden less than he fears Trump if Trump was allegedly a Soviet agent, a Russian agent?
He doesn't. And this was probably the biggest media lie of the last 4 years. Notwithstanding some of the rhetoric that came out of the administration, if you actually examine the Trump administration's policy, it was quite tough on Russia. Just ask the Marines who were in eastern Syria that schwacked a bunch of Russian mercenaries. There was actual tough policy on the ground that the media did not give the administration credit for. We called out Russia for their cyber infiltration of our infrastructure, a variety of things. We repeatedly sanctioned the Russians. And I think Trump himself probably was feared more by Putin than the Biden administration is right now. And I know that there's a lot in the media who would disagree with that statement. But the fact is, Putin is playing to his domestic base. I think they have Duma elections in the fall. So he's trying to stir up that sort of patriotic, nationalist Russian base right now. I'm not sure he's going to be successful, but this is a very, very dangerous situation. Now, if you ask our good friend Jerry Hendricks what we could do, he would say you could take a page out of the Cold War playbook. We used to practice emergency movements of U.S. troops to Europe during the Cold War. They were called reforgers, return of forces to Europe.
You could do something similar along with large economic sanctions. You could surge the army into the Baltics and Poland. You could get the Air Force into Ramstein, the Navy into the Black Sea and the High North. You force Germany to pull out of NS2 at a minimum. You know, you plan to stay in Europe for a year. You also simultaneously surge to Taiwan as well, because China may try something while we're distracted in Europe. I mean, this is the high-stakes geopolitics we're playing right now. And I just fear we don't have the national will right now to stand up. And if America is seen to be weak, you can guarantee that every, you know, rogue state, every Salafi jihadist group is going to be testing our limits. Because it's not just Russia and China. It's also Iran. It's North Korea. We still have terrorist groups that want to destroy us in our way of life. The world is a very dangerous place right now, and it requires American strength in order to make it less dangerous. Again, this is not amateur hour. This is very dangerous.
Now, going back to your days as a Marine intel person, and you're on House Armed Services, I don't know what kind of information they give you. Do we know what Ukraine, what Russia is going to do? I mean, do we have the capabilities to actually intercept their military orders, and we know what they're going to do before they do it?
It's possible. I'm not privy to that information, but it is certainly possible. I just don't know what level of placement and access we have and how high quality our sources are, whether they be human sources or signals intelligence sources. But ultimately, I think it comes down to, you know, what is Putin prepared to do? What are his intentions? Is he just saber rattling for domestic purposes? Does he actually intend to seize the Donbass, you know, and never let go of it for geopolitical purposes? You know, it's quite valuable geopolitically.
Why is that? Would you explain to people what the Donbass is and why it matters to him? Everyone understood Crimea. That was the Black Sea. That's where their old port was. He wanted Crimea back. Why the Donbass?
Well, I mean, I think beyond sort of like it's refers to the Donetsk and Luhansk region of Ukraine, if I'm saying that correctly. It's quite valuable, as I understand it, in terms of its water resources, in terms of sort of mineral resources and other things that it can actually provide to Crimea. And then, of course, there is just sort of the historical Russian connection to the region. And again, I just come back to this basic point that I think Putin is trying to not only mess with the NATO alliance structure, but also a play to a domestic audience. And obviously, we've had high profile cases of opposition figures, which have been Putin allegedly, which have been poisoned allegedly by the Kremlin, a new term I am now coining called being Putin on your show right now. I think all of that suggests to Putin that he needs to shore up his domestic source of support, and this is a good way of doing it.
Under the NDAA, do we have arrangements to base troops in the Baltics? Do we have actual NATO troops there beyond a squad?
Well, this was certainly something that was discussed in the previous administration with Ambassador O'Brien. The question was, how do you get troops stationed in Germany and in Western Europe and push them out into the eastern flank and into the Baltics? And I think it's fair to say that we're not anywhere close to where we need to be. Obviously, Poland in recent years has offered to host an enhanced U.S. troop presence. They offered to name the base like Trump base or something. I think we should take advantage of that. I think you want your troops forward deployed. You want them constantly rotating. You don't want them in garrison in Germany. You actually want them patrolling the eastern flank of NATO, particularly in the Baltic states. And oh, by the way, that's a much more fun and productive deployment if you're on active duty. That's where you want to be. You actually want to be out there mixing it up as opposed to just doing PowerPoint slides in garrison. So we are nowhere close to where we need to be in terms of changing our force posture in NATO. The problem, I think, with NATO is we tend to focus solely on inputs, right? Every country needs to meet their 2% of GDP goal. That's all well and good, but we really need to focus on outputs. What is that 2% actually getting us? Are we coordinating with our allies in order to create a credible deterrent posture that sends a signal to the Russians, you can't get away with this?
Well, I'm going to coin another term. The Biden administration is demonstrating the Packers effect. They are retreating. And by retreating...
How dare you.
Well, it's true. It's absolutely true. They're running off the field. And right now, they ought to be doing a Browns-like drive into the 7th Fleet, into the Taiwan Straits, as opposed to a Packers retreat. But you're right. Being Putin goes along with the Packers retreat. So... two new terms on the Hugh Hewitt Show this morning, Congressman Gallagher. Let's play that again, just so everyone can see Aaron Rodgers.
Oh,
yeah, just one more time.
Should be correct, but unfortunately for this.
All right, we're having trouble.
Come up with the correct response. Who wanted to kick that field goal? That is a great question. Should be correct, but unfortunately for this game today,
I think Congressman Gallagher, the draft is coming up. Maybe they'll get a new field goal kicker. What do you think?
Microaggression, Hugh. That was a microaggression.
Microaggression. I know you're very, very touchy. All right, Congressman, be well. Follow him at Rep Gallagher on Twitter. Follow me to the next segment, America. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. This is a remarkable period of time for religious liberty cases. An Alliance Defending Freedom is out there on the front line. This is a unique moment, in fact, when you are called on to defend that guarantee of religious liberty in working with the Alliance Defending Freedom. It's your moment. Today, you can stand up with ADF by going to adflegal.org/Hugh. That's adflegal.org/Hugh. Or for more information, you can call 866-359-9644. That's 866-359-9644. To tell you what I mean, I'm joined by John Birch, who is the counsel to the Alliance Defending Freedom on some of these most recent, former Michigan Solicitor General. We're not going to hold that against him. He's from that state up north. They don't know anything about football, but he does know about religious liberty. Good morning, John. How are you?
I'm doing terrific, Hugh. How are you?
I don't know if I ever have talked to a Michigan Solicitor General before. You didn't go to Michigan Law, did you?
I did not. Actually, Minnesota.
Okay, well, there you go. That's a redemption. I went to Michigan Law. John, tell us about the most recent case where California attempted to shut down home churches and the Supreme Court rebuked it.
This is a great win for religious liberty. We know that in recent months, a number of California orders that have restricted church worship, whether that be forcing them to only be outside, putting caps on the number of people that could attend and things like that, have been struck down by the Supreme Court. And this one involved home worship or Bible studies and things like that. So if you wanted to go to a concert, say, and there was a pop singer, you could have as many people as you wanted in a suite, and they could all be spending time together, talking together, even singing along with the singer on stage. And that was just fine. But if you wanted to have a small gathering of more than three families in your home for a worship service or a Bible study, where you might similarly be spending time together, chatting, maybe even singing, then that was forbidden.
And it's almost uniquely stupid, John. I've been teaching con law for 25 years, and the idea that the state of California and the city of L.A. could prohibit worship in private homes of more than three families at the same time that they are allowing crowds in the thousands and other venues, it's almost monumentally stupid. And yet it only got five votes. The chief, who's a friend of mine, I believe I know why he wrote, did not join the majority. Why do you think the chief sat it out?
Well, I'm not sure, because I agree with you that this is the easy case. It's like shooting ducks in a barrel. I think there's a strong argument that given the privacy that you have in your own home and your right to religious expression, that you might be able to have these types of services, even if California wasn't allowing similar gatherings to take place elsewhere. But it should be crystal clear to everybody that when you've got like activities taking place and the secular activity is allowed and the religious activity is prohibited, that that's the most basic violation of the free exercise clause that you can get.
It is the most obvious violation. That's why I think the Chief Justice was arguing that it was either moot or not yet ripe, which is a little bit difficult thing to argue at both points. But he was arguing it's an emergency situation. It's too fluid. And he stayed away from the three liberals and their reasoning. My question is now, John, given the number and string of defeats suffered by the opponents of religious liberty, will they leave people alone in their homes now, whether it's Michigan or California or any other overreaching state? Have they gotten the message that this court, these five, will strike it down if they treat faith-based expressions of activity differently than they do other secular activity?
I think so. And the Supreme Court majority went out of its way to highlight how absurd this has been, just to make sure everybody got the message. They say about halfway through the opinion, this is the fifth time the court has summarily rejected the Ninth Circuit analysis of California's COVID restrictions on religious exercise. It's unsurprising that such litigants are entitled to relief. California's system contains myriad exceptions and accommodations for comparable secular activities, thus requiring the application of strict scrutiny, which is the highest test that courts apply in the constitutional law rubric. So, you know, you fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on me. Five times, I would certainly hope that California and the Ninth Circuit would have gotten the message.
Did you have to brief this, John?
No, we were not directly involved in this one, although we've been involved in numerous other of the church closure cases. We're just enjoying the fruits of yet another great opinion, relying on some of the previous work.
And has ADF gone and filed with the other offenders the opinion of the five in this case? Are they busy making sure the record is everywhere obvious and made so to government authorities that are hostile to religion?
Oh, absolutely. We're going to be citing the fifth time quote to every single court that's still dealing with one of these. Although they're really starting to slim out now. Most circuits have followed the U.S. Supreme Court's lead. They haven't been quite so unrepentant as the Ninth Circuit, and have been very good about making sure that free exercise continues to reign at just about every level.
Well, thank you for your efforts. We got to keep ADF in the field, America. We need your help today. Step up. Go to adflegal.org/you. adflegal.org/you. Join ADF in preserving religious liberty, not just in small group settings and in private homes, but wherever there is a church of any faith or any organization, ADF will defend them. Or you can simply call right now, 866-359-9644 for more information. 866-359-9644 or go to adflegal.org/Hugh. adflegal.org/Hugh. Come back for hour three of today's Hugh Hewitt Show.
Portions of the Hugh Hewitt Show are brought to you by Alliance Defending Freedom.
Bonjour, hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined by Matt Continente, who you see on Meet the Press and columnist of the Washington Free Beacon. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
I'm well, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
I am engrossed in this book that George Bush has out, Out of Many, One. It's about America's immigrants. It's beautiful paintings, but the narratives included. Have you seen it yet?
I have. They sent me a copy. I agree. He's a fantastic painter.
A fantastic painter, but the stories are so full of suffering and they're so agonizing to read that I have a conversation with the former president tomorrow and we'll talk mostly about the stories. He's been out talking about immigration. I don't know where you are on immigration. In British politics, there are wets and dries. On immigration, I am both wet and dry. Let everybody stay, but finish the wall. Where is Matt Continente?
No, that's been my position for about 15 years since I started covering the immigration debate during George W.'s presidency. And I've always felt that he didn't quite understand the dynamics within the Republican Party, Hugh, on the issue of immigration. He's always had this kind of moral core about the immigration issue. He doesn't really understand how other people might interpret it differently, and also how people's experiences on the border might differ from his own lived experience.
Now, I don't think it's that hard of a problem to solve legal immigration either. Because if you combine the dry position of finish the wall with the wet position of everybody stays who's not involved in violence, both sides get their most pressing demand and you have a compromise. Am I oversimplifying? I've had the same position since a 2004 book. Finish the double-sided fencing and let everybody stay who's not a criminal. It just doesn't seem that hard to me, Matt.
Well, one issue is sequencing, Hugh. You know, a lot of people remember the 1986 immigration reform under Reagan, which promised strict enforcement and an amnesty. What happened was the amnesty happened, but the enforcement ended up being rather lax. And so a lot of border hawks say, finish the wall first and then deal with the illegal population here at home. Now, that has not been the position of the Democrats, or at least the modern Democrats, the current Democrats, who don't want any wall. They think it's racist and who basically adopted a position of more or less open borders.
They have, and we have to get them off that position because that will not fly. But I don't think the sequencing is that hard either. I mean, if I were king of the forest, not queen, not duke, not earl, I would say finish the wall and provisional purple cards for 3 years, and if the wall isn't finished, the purple cards are revoked. And it's not even that hard to figure out who can stay if they use a draft board model. I mean, I've written about this probably as much as you have. It's just not the Manhattan Project. This is not that difficult a problem if people will break it down into its component parts. And I don't know if I'm in la-la land or whatever, but it just seems to me it's never been that difficult. It's just that the voices on either end of the spectrum are very loud.
Yeah, that's true. But you hit on one thing there in your answer there, Hugh, which is the breaking down to the component parts. You know, I recently read John Boehner's memoir, and he made the point that he always believed it's my job, Hugh. I have to. He always believed in breaking down the immigration issue, doing it piece by piece, small bills. And of course, that has been opposed by the Democrats as well, who I think like having immigration as a wedge issue in order to split the Republican Party between the grassroots and its shrinking support in corporate America. What's changed, though, since Boehner's time and since George W.'s time, is that I think immigration has become a winning issue for Republicans, or at least not as harmful to Republicans as many Republicans believed, say, a decade ago.
I agree. But John Boehner, his bringing it down, that's the old Dean Martin Republican approach. Let's have a drink and every night we'll solve another bill. I'm talking about one big package. And Kissinger's diplomacy is the rule to solve any problem, make it bigger so that there are more things to trade and swap out. So Boehner, one by one, always engaged the hawks and always made them angry because they weren't getting the one thing that they want, which is a double-sided fence running about 800 to 900 miles on the border. There are some areas of the border that are impassable. And I don't think it's tenable for the Democrats to keep opposing that after this, but yet they keep opposing it. Is it your understanding that Trump was offered that deal in his first 2 years?
I'm not so sure about that. And I think that again, it all comes down to are the guarantees that the wall is going to be there. You know, when Trump adopted the wall as his kind of signature issue on the campaign, the Democrats very rapidly ran away from their previous support for the wall. And but I think one thing, just to step back here, we need to understand there's one issue right now where Joe Biden is playing defense domestically, and that's immigration. And so it's now, I think, to the Republicans' advantage to keep up the pressure on the border and keep talking about the crisis here, because it's clearly making Biden make mistakes and unforced errors, such as his kind of pirouette on the whole refugee cap issue last week.
I agree. And I would like for them to make an offer that's too good to turn down, which is, you know, everybody all in free except criminals and we get the wall. I don't think the Democrats can turn that down. Let me turn to the Ukraine quickly with you, Matt. Putin's put 150,000 troops on the border, according to the National Interest, including bombers and fighter aircraft. He's poised to invade. Do you think Biden will do anything if he does?
Well, right now, the offer on the table is for a summit with Putin. In fact, the readout of the conversation between the two national security advisors, ours and the Russians, wasn't talking about Ukraine, wasn't talking about Navalny, who's on the verge of death, the great democratic opposition leader in Russia. It was talking about the summit. I don't understand how you could put the summit out there while Putin is engaging in this malign behavior. I think the first step in order to deter Putin is to say no summit until you begin to draw down your troops on the Ukrainian border. It's a very unstable and, I think, dangerous situation here.
I also think that they have to announce that Nord Stream 2 is over. Nord Stream 1 is going to get pulled up by its brackets, and we're going to forward deploy more troops to the Baltics and Poland if you do this, because you will have threatened the other former republics of the Soviet Union, and we're going to respond. I don't think Biden will do that, but that's what we should do. What do you think happens under the cover of a Ukrainian invasion in the South China Sea, Matt Continetti?
Well, it'd be a distraction, and so China might be able to use the opportunity to make some grab in the South China Sea. But, you know, I think what's happening here, Hugh, is Putin wants to trick Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, into basically making the first incursion. That's what happened in Georgia in 2008, right? There was a buildup on the border of Georgia in those disputed regions. Then the then Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili, actually did a mini incursion to try to get the Russians to back off. The Russians then use that as an excuse to invade the entire country. I think what's happening right now is Putin is trying to intimidate or spook Zelensky into making the first move. So far, Zelensky hasn't done it. And I think he's actually provided a model of pretty strong leadership under great stress, which is kind of amazing for a man who, you know, had his previous job was a stand-up comic.
He could do with some assistance from the West that is explicit as to what will happen. If Putin does this, then we will do that. He could use that. We are not forthcoming about it. I want to go back to China for my last question, Matt. President Xi said, oh, not us. We're never going to expand. We're not going to be aggressors. It's nothing to see here. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. They are threatening Taiwan every single day. And the commander of U.S. Pacific Command, Indo-Pacific Command, said, look, it's a 3-year proposition, maybe a 6-year proposition. I can think it'd be a 3-week proposition. Has the United States made clear enough in your mind that it will take active measures to deter an invasion of Taiwan?
Well, no, because the policy has been for decades that of strategic ambiguity, and that we recognize that the one China policy, we support Taiwan, but we don't support its independence, at least technically. Now, what's interesting, though, is that Biden has been making some moves under the radar that show, I think, our growing alliance with an independent Taiwan, and such as the mission where he sent his friend, you know, former Senator Chris Dodd there just last week. He's increased those person-to-person contacts, which are of great annoyance to Beijing. But in terms of actually saying that this will be the red line, that action is taking upon Taiwan, we will come to its defense. Now, that hasn't happened yet. And, you know, just again, more broadly, and this applies to the Ukraine as well, Hugh, wars start when the aggressor thinks he has a chance, right? And so the way to prevent him from thinking that he has a chance is to be absolutely strong and clear about what we're willing to do to defend these kind of beleaguered democracies.
Let's underscore that. The famous Dean Acheson faux pas was to define American national security interests as not including the Korean Peninsula, not thereafter, long thereafter, Stalin okayed North Korea's invasion. The North Korean-South Korean war ensued, and it came to a stalemate after many years. We weren't clear. If we are clear about Taiwan and Ukraine and what follows, that won't happen. What are the odds of Joe Biden being clear?
Not great. I mean, again, and just look at that summit issue. I think the first step right now is to say there will be no summit as long as this buildup on the Ukrainian border continues, and as long as Alexei Navalny is close to death in a Russian prison hospital. I mean, that there needs to be clear demands. Right now, Biden is willing to give away the store for very little, and I think we see that not just in Russia. We also see it in Iran. We also see it in the Palestinian territories. And we see it in Afghanistan, where he overrules the advice of his generals and his Secretary of Defense because he wants to refight the 2009 debate over the surge in Afghanistan. So, no, I don't think the odds of clear, strong positions on these issues from Joe Biden is very great at all.
I agree. None dare call it appeasement, but that's what it is. Matt Continetti, good to see you. Follow him on Twitter @Continetti. Come back for more of the next hour of the Hugh Hewitt Show.